Special number 8263, Reel 7.
Captain Ives Ratliff, Reel 7. I was asking you about the work of the battery and regiment once the battle had actually started.
Well, there was a continuous series of attacks by various battalions in the two divisions going on, and these were always supported by artillery, but unfortunately the conditions prevailing at the time were so awful that they would take an objective, get to the top of the hill, but by the time they got there, the water, ammunition and so on, had just sort of run out. And immediate counterattack, and down the hill they'd come again. And this back and forth, up and then down again. It was really distressing. And the poor old infantry, they were suffering terrific casualties. Well, the Wavell and General Platt, they're all trying to find a solution to this thing, but because the only thing that they came up with was to blast them out of the place. And the road going through had been blown for, I think, a couple of hundred yards, blown off the hillside and covered by fire from the other side by these Italians, so that trying to do any repair there were just out of the question. Anyway, these attacks went on, and then they had to retreat. And we heard, but I never saw it, that the solution to their success was to get the mules to take the water and stuff up. They'd been devoiced so that they wouldn't, on the night attack, they wouldn't give the position away. Well, once they would get to the top, there they stayed, because they would have their water, they had their ammunition, whatever, anything, it all went with them. So the Italians started feeling the cold a bit. But these barrages just went, as a matter of course. They weren't very heavy ones, probably just a few hundred rounds.
How long would it last normally if you were called upon to shoot infantry?
Well, probably an hour, sometimes an hour and a half. It all depended upon the intensity of the gunfire. Of course, a certain amount of conservation had to be taken into account, because the logistic problems of getting all this stuff from the railheaded Castle up to us, and the problems there, which we knew about.
Had to watch your ammunition
stores. Yeah, we didn't have to stint it, but at the same time, it didn't have to be over generous. But it depended upon the seriousness or the requirement of the objective, I suppose. They were all, the consideration was made by those in command of that particular situation. But we were never short of ammunition.
Was the artillery being centrally controlled by a division at that stage, or were you actually allocated to particular brigades?
As far as I know, for these ordinary things, we supported the Worcestershire battalion, and anything that they did, we'd give them the artillery.
By you, is this your regiment or your battery?
Battery.
The battery. So it was one battery per battalion, was it?
Yeah, I suppose the things were interlaced, because the situation that we were in there couldn't be rigid. I mean, the attacks going on all over the place at different times. You know, there's Indian battalions, the HLI, Camerons. Once these people got up to their objective and there they consolidated, then at night we would have every gun was loaded with the range of the DF tower. It was usually charged three, and they were on these on defensive fire, and every gun, one of the detachment to turn two on, four off, two on, four off, sort of thing. See? And the only thing he had to look for up in the objective was the very light signal. And we told what it would be, red over green over red, or green, green, red, whatever. And immediately that happened, I didn't bother to go around waking people. He just pulled the firing lever and let the round off. You see, and that acted as a sort of reveille trumpet. And everyone took post very smartly and just loosed off. And I think the different situation, there were a different number of rounds to be fired, probably 5 or 10 per gun.
Did you have a lot of defensive fires?
Well, every night there's these things happening, but we didn't fire really every night, but frequently it happened when the battalions would put in a night plant attack.
Other than very lights, what other means of communication did you have to keep in touch with the infantry?
Well, the infantry married up with our OP. So we at the guns had no direct contact with them. Our contact was to the OP.
And he was up with the infantry.
It'd be normal OP or the forward OP, the mobile one, instead of, you know, having all sorts of equipment with him. He'd be just, you know, going along with the attack. And giving the fire that the battalion or company commander or whoever wanted.
I think you were saying earlier that there was difficulty with Lion because the lines kept breaking.
Yeah, that happened quite often. We had the continuous line parties going out to, you know, repair damage. In fact, one of our chaps, Barker, I think his name was, he got a MM for his effort, you know, keeping the line intact.
If there was a request to do a shoot, how long would it be before you could actually start firing?
Well, if it was a spontaneous thing, you know, we could do it straight away. So long as the battalion or company commander or the OP established, you know, the thing out on the map, and, you know, give line, range and angle of sight from that, and then correct by ranging, it could go straight in, you know, 5-10 round gunfire, you know, for the whole troop of the battery.
Did you do a lot of firing off the map as opposed to being directed by...
Well, this I wouldn't know, you see. You know, because I was, you know, I was a layer. And the information for corrections to the line of range or whatever would come from the GPO. Now, how he got his information, I wouldn't know. More than likely, it would come from... the OP. You see, even the if they would see a big counterattack ready to, you know, about to take place, you know, they'd come howling down the thing, mic target, mic target, mic target, you see, and that would be given as a map reference. The OP wouldn't bother about, you know, because he could read off a thing like that on the map. and then the whole regiment would concentrate on that particular map reference, and just, you know, probably, you know, say 5 rounds gunfire, 10 round gunfire, and I'd just make mincemeat of, you know, probably Italian company or the colonials or whatever.
Were most of the shoots battery or regimental, or were they at a, you know, a larger scale?
Sometimes the John Gordon, of course, was responsible for our troop, and Esmond White. But they used to take it in turns to go up to the OP. And the one or two of the other officers did the same thing. But it all depended upon the nature of the target. You see, if it was a pinpoint target, like a machine gun nest that they'd spotted, but they just used the one gun with, you know, very, very concise corrections to the line or the range. But if it was something larger, like, you know, a lot of infantry moving around the place, you know, have time to sort of go into such precision for firing.
Did you ever do any counter-battery firing?
Well, if we did, we weren't really filled in on... There wasn't a lot of information being bandied around. The sort of thing that would happen, well done chaps, damn good shoot, and things, knocked a company for six or something like that. But, you know, there's very little information.
What about the Italian artillery? How did that perform?
Well, as I said earlier, when we were doing this precision shooting, you know, for the plotting of the whole campaign, or this particular battle, I should say, the plus and the minus, and then call it a day. But all through the period, there were shells falling about in different parts of the valley, but not in any intensity. They're just, you know, 2-3 rounds, probably, you know, half a mile away from us, to our rear, or to the left or right. Nothing of intensity.
Did you
on the actual, you know, the big thundering barrage where we had 550 rounds a gun? Well, there's so much banging going on for 3.5 hours that you didn't know what was coming back. I mean, if it was there, you didn't see it. Because, anyway, you know, time to start looking around for it.
Was this in the support of the final attack?
Yeah. We had two or three reasonably heavy support program, gun programs, probably 200 rounds a gun, 100 rounds a gun. But the big, for the big battle, that was really something. And that I worked out at that time, the two divisions and the number of regiments and so on, that there were probably about 108 guns in the valley. Mm-hmm. And for days, this ammunition had been brought in, you know, from Cassler, all manner of transport. I mean, you had the Cape coloured South Africans, had our own people, there were Indians, any vehicle that could be commandeered was commandeered in the south, was brought up, and we had 550 rounds, which was our thing for that one barrage and nothing else. And we started on, well, 4th Indian Division started at 4 minutes to 7, and we started at 7 o'clock in the morning. And this four minutes before us was, you know, the reverberation, you know, along the valley. The sound reminded me of some king-sized chap getting a sheet of corrugated iron, you know, and tearing it, and the sound being magnified. It was so, you know, deafening. Anyway, 7 o'clock, we opened, and the program was that it started with 7 rounds a minute, and gradually, you know, reducing, until it got as low as half a round a minute, and that was at 10:30. So we had 3.5 hours of this. The gun pit collapsed, you know, the sandbags and so on, and the special paint that one has, you know, on artillery pieces, which was supposed to be heat resistant, the paint was all bubbling up and sort of becoming brittle and breaking off. And by the time you finish, I mean, there's hardly any paint left on the piece. Yeah. And the sand blowing up, the cordite fumes. And at 10:30, we were given the order to rest. And there's the whole detachment just sitting around, you know, probably in the number 5 and 6, the shell and cartridge case, you know, and their laps, and this intense burning heat, you know. Everyone just fell asleep, you know. They were drugged with the cordite fumes and the exhaustion, because it just couldn't let up, you know. It just continuous. The banging of the gun, that didn't help. We had all this stuff, you know, behind you, at the side of you, in front of you. Oh, it was really some picnic. And now we're firing something like about probably 8,000-10,000 yards. And on the crest, right along the target area, you know, the shell explosion and the concentration of shell fire, that it was like night, a strip of night time. It was so black, and you could see the flash, the shells exploding in this blackness. God, I was grateful I wasn't in amongst it, because anything that didn't kill, get killed up there. You know, talking about human beings, and mules or anything, would certainly suffer from blooming shell shock. It was murder.
You were saying earlier on about building up the ammunition stocks and that you had logistic difficulties.
Mm.
What were these difficulties?
This was mainly the shortage of transport. You see, not only the question of bringing up of ammunition. There were all the other stores which had to be brought up, like, you know, rations, clothing, spares, you name it. I mean, it all had to come, and it all the way back from Castler. Well, it was all right as far as Castler, because they'd opened the railway line. I know that some of it was... there was a narrow, very narrow gauge railway between Castler and Keren. Well, they got this thing in working order, and they had a couple of locomotives, and you know, some of the rolling stock that had been left behind by the Italians, undamaged. That, of course, was used to the best advantage. It wasn't nearly enough. You know, it was a single line thing, I think. And the rest was all road.
How did your staff get brought up to you then, in your forward positions?
Three tonners used to come down. They'd come. There was a very, very good road all the way, well, right through, right up to Asmara, even to Ambrolagi in Abyssinia. And all they had to do is to, you know, come off the road and negotiate. The sand in this riverbed thing was fairly, fairly good. You know, one or two vehicles, I suppose, did get bogged down in it. But there were so many there ready to help and tow people out. I mean, our wagon lines went very far from there, so they didn't got one of our quads out with the winch rope, if necessary.
You say that you had to conserve ammunition, but you were never seriously short of it. Were you ever short of anything during this battle?
No, at Karen, there was no shortage. We had ample water. As I'd mentioned earlier, that each vehicle, you know, had this galvanised tank, I suppose it held about 40 gallons or something. Well, that was always at hand for brewing up. We only had had tea, sugar, and tin milk, cigarettes. Those ones. We used to get a cigarette ration of, I think it was 2 ounces of tobacco and 50 cigarettes. There were, earlier on, Victory V's, which were coffin nails. But the story went around that, this is because we're an Indian division. But for some reason, suddenly we started getting British-made cigarettes like Park Drive and Cancetus and Players and St. Bruno tobacco, which at that time I used to smoke a pipe, and occasionally we got a rum ration, so I had to douse this tobacco up with rum and put the lid on it, put it out on a rock, the boiling sun, and really cook it, and it was really great smoking.
Was tobacco very important to the troops?
Yeah, well, much the same as it is to anyone else. Some needed to calm their nerves, some for pleasure. But for the months, for weeks, that there wasn't any tobacco available, and no one sort of suffered very much. I had bad dreams over it all. I mean, they just... I don't know whether it's a soldier's adaptability to these things, but no one worried about us not having any drink. You know, they would have liked it, certainly. But quite all right.
What about the food? Did that...
The food, the same old, you know... Savoy Hotel menu, fried bully in the morning, cold lunch, and stewed at night. Sometimes we'd have a break and change for breakfast with that tin bacon, which was very, very salt indeed, and almost unpalatable. And then, you know, this usual old army tea.
Did you have a cookhouse?
Yeah, it was on a culvert under the bridge. You had the command post under one archway in the cookhouse under the other. The only thing we didn't like was, and this happened nearly every night at Karen, bang on 7 o'clock in the evening, there I'd stand easy, you know, leave one man a gun with the round up the spout, and the rest would go to the cookhouse. and this wretched bully stew and rice pud, something like that. And sitting around there, the whole battery, on sand. And then the Italians would open up a few rounds in some direction or the other, you see. Take post, you see. And the flying hoofs and all this thing. You had to leave your foot as well. When you got back there, there was a crust of sand on the rice pudding and on this thing. And your tea was cold, that had sand floating about on the top,
Did this happen regularly?
It was almost every night without fail. But we always sort of said, surely the jacket in tonight, But never, it was always there. Just almost bang on 7 o'clock.
Presumably the intention was to spoil your dinner.
Well, they could have amused themselves in better ways by destroying someone's artillery or something. But,
what sort of accommodation did you have there? Did you have
any? No accommodation at all. You just slept out in the open. Just on your ground sheet with a haversack as a pillow. And three blankets.
Did you have mosquito nets?
No. I would have given anything to have had one. Not for night use, but for day use. Yeah, with all this carnage that was going on up in these hills, British, Indian, Italian, colonials, mules, both sides have been, massacred, as it were. Not, in no man's land, not being able to have been taken away and buried, and the flies had a whale of a time. And a lot of these flies were blown down the valley, and they were great fat things. And they just sort of plop onto you, your face or something, and you hit them. A fly usually sees your hand coming and can fly away, but these things, couldn't move that fast. They were so fat with blood. And it's a great jollop of blood on you. So when we went firing and at rest, as it were, we'd get under a bush, and nearly everyone cheated. And they opened up their first field dressing thing and took out the gauze thing, which was about 18 inches by 18 inches, and made a sort of protection to the face.
And they had a mask.
A mask, you tucked it inside the helmet. Not the steel helmet, but the woolsey, or the pitopi, whatever. And you just cover your face, and you're able to snatch an hour's sleep during the day in between shoots. But without that, it wouldn't have got any peace, because there were so many of these things. It was really bad.
How far behind the guns did you normally sleep then?
Immediately behind. We made up either, you slept in the sand, or you got these ammunition boxes and made up